Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, a few problem spots. I-10 eastbound at 43rd Avenue, a crash in the median. I-10 westbound, a crash at 27th Avenue. And on the 60 eastbound, a crash in the median at Val Vista. Slight chance of thunderstorms this afternoon with a high of 83 degrees. Chance of storms continues into tonight with overnight lows in the lower 60s. Very slight chance of more rain tomorrow with a high of 81. It's partly cloudy, 82 degrees right now at KJZZ. Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine is in Maryvale right now on a mission to woo voters in Spanish. As KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports, the senator from Virginia is the first candidate on the 2016 presidential ticket to venture west of the state fairgrounds during a trip to the valley.
The Washington Post has reported that Kaine's ability to speak Spanish is one reason why he edged out two cabinet-level Latinos to become Hillary Clinton's running mate. Maryvale is predominantly Latino, and Kaine will try to connect with residents by using the language skills he developed as a Catholic missionary in Honduras. But a Univision Noticias poll shows that being bilingual is not necessarily key to winning the Latino vote. Roughly 70% of Latinos interviewed for the poll said they would not be influenced by whether a candidate can speak fluent Spanish. Kaine is expected to talk about what's on the line as voters weigh nominees who both have high unapproval ratings and encourage people to cast their ballots early. He's also scheduled to appear in Tucson this evening. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A federal judge in Phoenix will hear arguments today about whether to block Republican groups from certain activities at the polls. Democrats are arguing Republican monitoring efforts to prevent fraud will actually intimidate voters, while Republicans say it's necessary to have people watching the voting process. But what activity at the polls is legal and what crosses the line? KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports.
Arizona law allows each political party to train observers to watch voting inside the polls. Both Democrats and Republicans have been training these observers in recent weeks. Robert Graham of the Arizona Republican Party says in past elections, only about 150 people would volunteer to be party observers. But this year,
we have probably over 1,000 poll watchers today that are going through training. I mean, we're having a hard time making sure they go through the training properly, but we'll get them there.
Graham says Donald Trump's warnings that the election could be rigged drummed up interest. He says it's a good thing for all the parties to have observers in the polls.
This way, people just know a little bit more that they're being watched and their behavior needs to stay in line with the law.
Only observers with an official letter from the county chairman of their party will be let in, and they aren't allowed to talk to voters or record anything inside the polling place. At a training for county poll workers this week, Tonya Tunnell of the Maricopa County Elections Department told poll workers what these political party observers can and can't do. She said they can raise questions or concerns with those in charge at the polling place.
But otherwise, they should be leaving you other board workers alone. They should not be impeding the voting process, and indeed, they should not be talking to the voters.
Democrats allege in their lawsuit the Arizona Republican Party may be encouraging their observers to engage in what Democrats claim is intimidation. Republican officials have been quoted in the past saying party observers can follow voters out of the polling place and to the parking lot and take pictures if they suspect wrongdoing. Which gets to another rule at the polling place. There's a 75-foot zone around it where no political signs or campaigning is permitted. Only voters and their kids or helpers are allowed. Again, Tonya Tunnell.
So if you're just a citizen that wants to watch the process or if you'll have those campaign supporters, you would stay outside the 75-foot zone.
One citizen group planning to be outside supports Donald Trump and is called Stop the Steal. It's recruiting volunteers to do so-called exit polling in an effort to prevent voter fraud. Over 100 people in Arizona have signed up on Stop the Steal's website. Democrats say this could be a way to interfere with voting and want a court to block Stop the Steal from intimidating voters. Another group planning to watch the polls is the Oath Keepers. They're made up of current and former law enforcement and military members.
It is just basically a surveillance operation, an observe and report.
Jim Arroyo is an Oath Keeper based in Chino Valley. He says they'll be on the lookout for voter intimidation and fraud, as well as people dropping off several ballots in violation of Arizona's new ballot harvesting law.
We just become good witnesses and photo document anything we can and just basically dial 911 and let the police handle it.
But Secretary of State Michelle Reagan issued new guidelines Wednesday, which included a warning that taking video or photos outside the 75-foot zone could still have an intimidating effect. A Washington, D.C.-based voting rights group has said they are worried Oath Keepers will intimidate voters and has asked the Justice Department to investigate. But Arroyo says those concerns are unfair. He says Oath Keepers is nonpartisan and there to prevent intimidation. The provision of the Voting Rights Act that deals with voter intimidation has rarely been enforced. William Yeomans is a former Justice Department lawyer.
It prohibits any kind of physical interference with someone who's trying to get to the ballot box. It prohibits any kind of intimidating statements or conduct, any kind of show of force.
The Justice Department used to send federal observers to Arizona in part to watch for voter intimidation. That's not in effect this presidential year since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down part of the Voting Rights Act. But Maricopa County elections officials say they're still expecting 20 Justice Department observers in the county on November 8th. The Justice Department says it hasn't officially announced the states it will visit. Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
That story mentioned that yesterday, Secretary of State Michelle Reagan issued new guidance on conduct at polling places to prevent discrimination and intimidation. And joining us now with more is KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block. And Jude, tell us what prompted Secretary Reagan to put out this guidance, and what does she say?
Well, the context for all of this is that we're seeing Donald Trump saying this election could be rigged. He's asking his supporters to watch the polls. And there's groups who've said they'll be conducting so-called exit polls to find out how people are voting and make sure there wasn't fraud. And of course, there's this lawsuit going on here in Phoenix with the Arizona Democratic Party trying to get a judge to block the Republican Party and Trump supporters from certain activities at the polls that they say will intimidate voters. So all that's going on. I'd say the biggest takeaway from Reagan's guidance is that while there is a 75-foot zone around the polling place where all sorts of activities are banned, like photography, campaigning, signs, people outside of that 75-foot zone still have to watch their behavior to make sure they're not intimidating voters. So even though there's free speech, there has to be a balance. And Reagan is warning things like aggressively questioning voters or threatening signs about voter fraud or, quote, aggressively or ostentatiously displaying weapons all could potentially intimidate voters.
And we know that Arizona is a state that allows gun owners to either open carry or carry a concealed weapon, so that brings up a very important question. What are the rules about firearms at the polls?
In that 75-foot zone and in the polling place, firearms are not allowed under state law. Some polling places might be at a school, which will have its own rules about not having guns on campus. But for other places in public, generally outside of that 75-foot zone, regular gun laws apply, which basically means gun owners can carry their guns. But, you know, Reagan's guidance is saying even outside that 75-foot zone, there could be some limits. They use this language, aggressive or ostentatious displays of weapons could be considered intimidating to voters. Her own spokesman admitted, you know, that's a tough definition to define legally, but they're actually saying, look, consider leaving your firearm in your car if you plan to come watch the polling place.
In the feature story of yours we heard just a couple of minutes ago, you talked to a member of the Oath Keepers who said he planned to call 911 if he saw anything suspicious. What does Reagan say about law enforcement?
Well, you know, what's interesting in this guidance is that it does say that excessive use of uniform law enforcement personnel may have the effect of intimidating voters. It calls for county poll workers to sort of consider that balance when deciding who to call if there is some kind of incident. I'm told that Maricopa County Sheriff's Office has 6 roving deputies that are dedicated to answering calls from poll workers if there's any kind of disturbance within the polling place or the 75-foot limit. Outside of that 75-foot zone, if somebody else calls 911, it would likely be just the regular police who would answer.
And Jude, finally, there's a very relevant hearing taking place this afternoon in the Arizona Democratic Party's case against Republicans and the group Stop the Steal. Explain to us what's at stake here.
So Democrats want a federal judge to issue a restraining order, basically blocking the Republican Party and this other group, Stop the Steal, from certain activities like harassing voters, questioning voters aggressively, following them and taking their photos. Republicans are saying that Democrats are just trying to, quote, create political mayhem rather than prevent actual misconduct. They say basically there's already laws in place against voter intimidation and that the relief Democrats want with a restraining order is just too broad, that it would infringe on protected free speech. So this will be a hearing in that case and we'll be waiting for the judge's ruling.
And KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block will have the latest. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
$187,000 new voters registered in the last 2 months in Arizona, and the presidential election is now just days away. The show's Lauren Gilger went out with some of the groups working to get out the vote before Election Day.
About a dozen teenagers are sitting around a table at Neighborhood Ministries in West Phoenix.
If you are walking Isaac today, please go with Victor. And if you're a Capitol, you'll go with Liz and myself.
And then they're off, teamed up with clipboards in hand, to spread out around the city and knock on doors.
My name is Aida.
Aida Pinuelas is a high school senior who's canvassing today for One Arizona, a coalition of advocacy groups dedicated to registering Latino voters.
I'm not old enough to vote, and I'm also not a citizen. This is my way of getting my voice heard.
On this day, she's making a second trip to registered voters' houses near 19th Avenue in Van Buren, doing what politicos call get out the vote.
Can I ask you, how do you plan on voting this election?
For who?
No, like, are you voting through mail? Are you going to the polling
location? Oh, I don't know. They sent me this paper that says where to go.
And especially with newly registered voters, it's not always as easy as it sounds.
Did you get, like, a yellow envelope through the mail? And in the yellow envelope, was there a green envelope too?
That is your early ballot, Pinuelas tells him.
You can either go to your polling location on November 8th, or you can fill it out and just turn it into your mailbox and your mailman will get it, and that's your vote.
One Arizona deployed hundreds of young people like Pinuelas over the last several months and registered more than 150,000 new voters, which communications director Peter Juarez says are predominantly Latino.
And now we move on and with Get Out the Vote.
And that's what both Democratic and Republican parties in Arizona are focusing on now.
It's knocking on doors, it's phone calls, it's delivering literature to doors, it's putting up yard signs, it's doing a number of things.
We've knocked on over 304,000 doors and made over 560,000 phone calls to voters.
That's Robert Graham, chairman of the Arizona Republican Party, and Stephen Slagaki, chairman of the Maricopa County Democratic Party. On the Democratic side, Slagaki says their efforts to turn out the vote are far ahead of where they were this time during the last presidential election.
We are greatly outpacing everything that we've done 4 years ago.
And Graham says the Arizona Republicans have 21 active field offices.
We've never had anything like this before in the past.
The Secretary of State's office reports that almost 190,000 new voters in the state have registered this election cycle. More than 90,000 of those are in Maricopa County, a phenomenon Graham attributes to Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump.
Donald Trump has created an interesting wave of registrations on the Republican side. So where we registered lots of people the last cycle, organically the party has grown because of the support for Donald Trump.
But to Samantha Pastross, executive director of the Arizona Advocacy Network, a nonpartisan organization that works for fair elections, that large number of new voters is also cause for concern.
There's a ton of new registered voters, which is great, but I think there's a lot of room for voter disenfranchisement and even voter intimidation.
Why? Pastross says this is the first presidential election in which local elections officials will not be required to get pre-clearance on polling locations from the U.S. Department of Justice to ensure a fair election for minorities.
We don't have the oversight we usually do, and as we've seen this year already, we've just had problem after problem.
Problems like the long lines voters in Maricopa County experienced during the presidential preference election in March. Elizabeth Bartholomew, spokesperson for the Maricopa County Recorder's Office, says they have 724 polling places this election and up to 4 electronic poll books at every single one.
So we are very confident that if there are any lines that voters will not be waiting in line any longer than 30 minutes.
But Pastrov says some of those 724 polling places are in the same location, which can create problems. And she's worried about lines.
We've already identified a number of polling locations that we think are going to have problems. These are polling locations where there are a lot of new voters in the precinct, where they have traditionally had problems, and where there is a high number of voters who are people of color.
The Arizona Advocacy Network will have volunteers staffing those polling locations on Election Day. But Bartholomew says the recorder's office sent out 1.5 million early ballots, and they've already gotten back over 900,000 of them.
Even though, yes, the numbers of registered voters have increased, so have those numbers of the permanent early voting list. So those are individuals who would not be going to the polls on Election Day.
For the show, I'm Lauren Gilger.
But even though more voters are casting their ballots early, many are still doing so in person rather than through the mail. And some of those voters are finding they have to wait in long lines. Casey Kuhn from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau is here with more on that. And Casey, you've been out for a bit looking at different polling places. What have you seen?
So in the West Valley, I've been to a few already. I went to the one in Glendale, and there were long lines yesterday, and there were long lines today. There are 25 different early voting locations, and it's not just the ones in the West Valley. Chandler and Gilbert have also seen hour-long lines. In Glendale, there was a two-hour wait. So I know today at least 50 people were lined up before 8 in the morning, which is when the location opens, including Michelle Dale, who got there at 7 in the morning and was first in line.
I need to work on Tuesday, and it's probably going to be long lines, so I wanted to get here and get it done early.
Other voters I spoke to just couldn't believe the wait time and even left to try voting somewhere else.
So, Casey, people are clearly frustrated with these long lines, just as they were during the presidential preference election in March. Did the recorder's office expect this?
No, actually, Elizabeth Bartholomew with the recorder's office says they weren't expecting this because normally people don't show up to the polls early to cast their ballots. Here's Bartholomew.
To vote early in person, that's usually not the primary method of voting voters choose to do. We've always seen very low turnout at these in-person early voting locations.
Bartholomew also said that in 2008's presidential election, there were also long lines for early voting.
So what does her office say that they're going to do about this?
Well, she says they're going to bring more staff to every single location on Friday. That's the last day for early voting. So they've also sent out additional computers, including to the one in Glendale, and additional ballot printers. Finally, Bartholomew says if people are just getting frustrated voting in person this week,
they can certainly go to their designated polling place on Election Day, and I guarantee you there'll probably be no lines.
So did everybody who was showing up at an early voting location to vote early see a long line?
Not when I went out to look at some other locations. At the Maryville location, which is about 10 minutes away from the Glendale location, this morning there were maybe 10 people there, so definitely not a long line there. And when I dropped off my own early ballot yesterday at the elections office downtown, I didn't have to wait at all.
That's KJZZ's Casey Kuhn. Thanks, Casey.
Thank you.
The Phoenix City Council has approved a new ordinance aimed at preserving historic buildings from demolition. A key component extends the amount of time between getting a demolition permit and wrecking balls hitting those buildings. The city estimates up to 300 demolition permit requests could be affected each year. With me to talk about the new ordinance is Jim McPherson, president of the Arizona Preservation Foundation. And Jim, what do you make of these new rules?
The policy is a win for historic preservation in the city of Phoenix. You know, it came at a time when we've been seeing an increase in development, both pro and con from the standpoint of historic preservation and adaptive reuse. And on the con side, there's some demolitions happening. And arising from some of those most recent demolitions, the Historic Preservation Commission and members of the preservation community and interested developers and community members thought we need to do something. We need to work to stem the tide of demolitions. So this policy was vetted through the city process and was adopted.
How big of an impact do you think it'll ultimately have?
Well, that's you know, hypothetical, and what it provides is some you know, breathing space. It increases the stay of demolition from 3 days simply in the downtown core to 30 days citywide for demolition permits for commercial properties 50 years of age or older, or individual properties that are eligible for designation. So that breathing space is important. So individuals in the preservation community and within the city, developers can really come to an understanding as to whether an affected building is historically significant and what are the options over and above demolition.
Is there a concern that this policy could, in some cases, just sort of delay the inevitable and delay demolition, you know, for a few extra weeks?
That's always the case in cities where similar policies are enacted and enforced. But it also has provided some good pause for all parties concerned to really look at preservation as an option. And we've been seeing more and more preservation happening, adaptive reuse happening in Phoenix. You look at the Warehouse District, and for example, and it's just getting a better understanding on the part of all parties concerned that there are options.
Are there buildings that you have an eye on right now that you think could be affected by this new policy?
Well, there are certainly buildings that we're thinking about. You look through the book Mid-Century Marvels, Commercial Architecture of Phoenix, 1945 to 1975, and you see example upon example of post-war architecture that is wonderful, but many of them are not historically designated. They certainly are eligible, and already, for example, we estimate 8 to 9% of the buildings in Mid-Century Marvels have been demolished.
Do you think that some of those buildings that are still standing that either could be just saved and maybe figure out a purpose for them later, or you think that, you know, there's some ideas sort of percolating about what you might be able to do or what developers might be able to do with those spaces? It sounds like you think maybe some of those could benefit already from this new ordinance.
Yes. There are examples upon examples of what can be done.
Jim McPherson is president of the Arizona Preservation Foundation. Jim, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mark.
Nations, communities, even individuals will mark major events or historical figures or just someone they cared about with a memorial of some kind. It can be a huge monument or statue or something a lot more subtle. U of A Associate Professor Susan Crane researches collective memory and historical consciousness, among other things. And tonight in Tucson, she'll be speaking as part of a presentation called Remembering and Forgetting with Memorials. Professor Crane, are memorials sometimes more significant to tourists or visitors rather than to people who live around them every day?
I do think that people get used to memorials, but people also expect memorials. One thing I learned really early on in my own career was I could never assume that anybody cares about remembering the past. So I don't take that for granted. But when people do decide that they care about something and they want to remember it, then you find that they might be willing to invest a lot of time, money, effort in creating something that will be long-lasting. The interesting thing then is to look at, does the original impulse to save something also translate into it having this long-lasting effect? Just to give you one example, we talked about the memorial fountain here at the University of Arizona. It's actually a memorial fountain that was dedicated in 1920 to help people remember University of Arizona students who had died in the service of their country in World War I. When you talk to most Arizona students today, they don't know what the fountain was dedicated for. They all know the fountain. It's a huge landmark on our campus. But very few of them will say, oh, that's a World War I memorial fountain. So the impulse to create the memorial and create it for having it be long-lasting, having it be there a long time, that works. But in posterity, do people always remember why the memorial was built? No, they don't.
Does that take away the impact of the memorial and the reason for having it at all? Or is it still important to have it there, regardless of whether people take the time to learn more about it?
What's interesting for me as a historian is to pay attention to when and how people do choose to care. You know, this is going to sound sacrilegious, but at any given moment, we could decide to destroy a memorial or destroy a monument. The changing meanings of monuments and memorials, for instance, to the American Confederacy, are very much an issue in American culture right now. So at any given moment, the status of a memorial is, in a sense, up for grabs. And I think that's important in our society, as in a democracy, that we're always thinking about what we choose to care about.
And so its relevance is in the eye of the beholder in some sense.
What I think is really important is that people are always aware that this is an investment that they can make, and they can choose to withdraw interest. Just because somebody 100 years ago thought it was absolutely important that we have this memorial, it meant something to them at the time. They hoped that posterity would care as much as they do, but they don't get to control that. And I think that's okay. What I do think is important is that as a society, we are constantly revisiting these commitments and that we decide again and again, do we still care about this? If we do, then we ought to be making efforts towards preservation, and we ought to be trying to make sure that people continue to visit a memorial or continue to interact with it in a meaningful way. And if it's no longer meaningful, or if the meanings are now offensive to us, then that's something worth revisiting.
Well, I want to ask where memorials cross into another area of your research of collective memory. Memorials play a role in our collective memories of what has happened, but also our sense of community of bringing us together.
So I do think memorials continue to play that role. So obviously people go to memorials or visit monuments because they feel a connection to it. And sometimes the connection they feel is historical curiosity. But for other people, the connection is personal. Maybe they have a family member who was involved in that event or knew that historical personage. So they feel a personal connection to it, and then it's meaningful in a different way. I do appreciate that you said collective memories, like you made it in the plural, as opposed to assuming that there's just one collective memory that maybe all Americans share because we're Americans. It tends to be more diverse than that. It varies by generations. It varies by families. It varies by communities. And within a single community, there could be lots of different people that have different kinds of relationships to a memorial.
Susan Crane is an associate professor at the University of Arizona, and tonight in Tucson, she'll be speaking as part of a presentation called Remembering and Forgetting with Memorials.
Phoenix is looking to get more shady, but in a good way. The city has a goal of a 25% shade canopy by 2030. Right now, around 13% of Phoenix is shaded. Alan Stevenson, the city's planning and development director, is helping lead this effort. I met him on a recent morning on 2nd Avenue and Van Buren, and yes, we were able to find some shade to stand under while we talked. He acknowledges having a quarter of the city under a shade canopy is a fairly large undertaking, and I asked him why the city's trying to do it.
There's really some fantastic benefits from trees from an aesthetic and livability standpoint, as well as a cooling effect. And so from the aesthetic standpoint, there's been studies that show that having healthy green trees increases property values by 2 to 10%. It really creates greater livability in an urban environment. So as the city is balancing doing our typical suburban development we've always had with our focus on urbanization as well, you really got to have trees to be that second go-between to get people after they get out of light rail, after they get off the bus, as they walk, they have a shade canopy to walk under. That makes walking all the more livable. It's more beautiful to do that as well at the same time. And then it also does provide some cooling effect to the city as well.
How much do you envision that this plan will encompass more trees, and how much can you build shade into the environment?
So for new development, it'll be a mix of those things. Where they have the room, it will be planting some trees. If they don't have room because of other things that are in place in those right-of-ways, there's lots of challenges of how we do development with what new projects are coming in an urban environment along with the streetscape that's there. And all that competes for space along with the trees to make those things work. So you have to figure out how to balance all those things to get an appropriate streetscape.
Yeah, so right here we're standing, there are some large palm trees which are not casting a ton of shade, some smaller trees, a covered patio right behind us. Is this kind of what you're envisioning, this combination of these trees will eventually get bigger and probably produce some shade, the non-palm trees, you have a covered patio right here, is that kind of what you're thinking about?
Absolutely. So this particular street on 2nd Avenue here was a City of Phoenix street project a few years ago where they shrunk the right-of-way, put on some on-street parking, put in the double row of trees you see here. So you have trees on the private property side, some were there, some were added. Then you have in the public right-of-way other trees that were planted. So you have this double row of trees to help create that shading impact. Then you have areas where you have a private development and they've installed a shade canopy so that as part of that canopy, that's providing some additional shade as well.
Cost-wise, how much are we talking about the city potentially spending on this?
We don't have cost estimates. It is something that the city is currently looking at, along with some other changes to our ordinances and requirements related to trees. But it is something that we're looking to build into all the different projects. So when there's a streetscape improvement going on, they'll have some money for trees in there. As a part of the Parks Department, when they're building a new park, they have money for trees that go in there. When the city builds new projects, fire stations, all those things, there'll be, you know, trees associated with those as well. But it is a challenge because the city's not building a lot of those as much as we used to anymore because of other fiscal reasons.
Is there a perception issue that you're going to have to work on as well, in the sense that when it's still, you know, 110, 112 degrees outside, is it still going to be tough, do you think, to convince people, yes, even though it's shaded, maybe you won't get a sunburn, it's still pretty hot out?
Yeah, there'll still be some challenges associated with that, and that's part of you know, how we urbanize and getting people to be able to be comfortable with a short walk. And you've got to, in order to even get people to look at doing that as a viable option, you've got to have in that infrastructure to make it that so they can do that walk.
Are there other cities that have done something similar to this, especially maybe ones that are either desert cities or cities with the kind of sunlight that we have that you're sort of modeling this program after?
There are a number of big cities. Los Angeles is one that has done that as well. They've had a big initiative over there to plant trees. And so that's in a similar effort. But it is something that across the country, as larger cities are dealing with, you know, some of the impacts of urbanization, what happens with, you know, with temperatures, they are looking at planting more trees because there is a big impact that you get just from a small effort into planting trees.
Do you think that ultimately this shade project will be an economic development tool for the city?
I think it will be, from the standpoint of creating livability and walkability and a good urban environment. And it's that good urban environment that millennials want to see. And that helps them say, yes, you know what, I want to choose this startup in Phoenix, Arizona, to go work for, versus some high-tech startup somewhere else in the country, because we've got a great urban environment.
Is there a certain irony here that in some parts of the city where development came, they had to cut down trees and other plants that cast shade? Now you're going back and having to replant that sort of after the fact?
Well, the city has for a number of years had revegetation requirements and reuse requirements. So as new development has happened in the suburban parts of the city, we require them to salvage the larger tree specimens and replant them on their parcels. So you see a lot of great desert mesquite trees and other you know, native desert trees that you now are out in the new developing areas of the city that were salvaged from those sites.
Do you think that 25% is an end goal, or do you think the city might eventually look for more than that?
I think it's a good aspirational goal right now for 2030. We'll have to evaluate that at that time and see where we're at and continue to evolve.
Alan Stevenson is Phoenix's planning and development director. We were talking about the city's goal of having 25% of Phoenix under a shade canopy by 2030.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hello.
I'm Brittany with Gals Walking Pals, and we're professional pet sitters and dog walkers, so we're here this morning to go on a walk together. Dozer is a miniature dachshund, and Maddie is a miniature pincher, so they're quite the mini duo. Dozer loves to mark his territory all over the neighborhood. He wants everyone to know that this is his neighborhood. Poop patrol! There's a lot of smells they can sniff, and other neighborhood dogs saying hi while we're walking by. And it just makes them so happy, and it gives them a little moment of joy in their busy day of sleeping.
That's Brittany Schuler walking some cute little doggies. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just think we need some cleaning up after, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. Almost two-thirds of Arizonans have experienced at least one adverse childhood experience, or ACE. The events are traumatic, and the effects can emerge decades later. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also describes the ACE numbers as similar to a cholesterol score for childhood trauma. With me to explain more about ACEs is Dr. Vinny Chalani, Section Chief for Adolescent Medicine at Phoenix Children's Hospital. And Dr. Chalani, what falls into the category of an adverse childhood experience?
Sexual abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, having a household member who is involved in drug use or mental illness, witnessing violence between adults is another example of an adverse childhood event. Household alcoholism, parental separation and divorce, and having an incarcerated household member also qualify as ACEs. So really, we're talking about events that are very significant and can be experienced as extremely stressful by children.
Does having one potentially lead down the road to more, even as an adult? Is that something that can be passed down through the generations?
You know, absolutely. There's a very strong tendency for ACEs to cluster, and ACEs oftentimes don't occur alone. In the ACE study in Arizona adults, for example, if you had one ACE, there was a 9 in 10 chance that you'd have two or more. And what's really interesting, too, is how ACEs cluster. It's not just the fact that they do, but how they disproportionately impact individuals from racial and ethnic minority groups and individuals from social and economic disadvantage, which really makes ACEs a social justice issue at its very core.
And how do the numbers on an ACE quiz, it's a 10-question quiz, give us insights on the long-term effects?
For example, with a score of 4 or more, you know, and 36% of Arizona adults had a score of 4 or more. At this level, compared to individuals who were not exposed to adverse childhood experiences, what you found was that with a 4 or score or more, people were more likely to be 2 times more likely to be smokers. They were 7 times more likely to have problems with alcohol, and they were 12 times more likely for risk for suicide. So really, the impact just exponentially multiplies as you accumulate ACEs over time.
Are there steps being taken now, as we know more, and in your position as well, to not only identify them, but also in some ways try to heal them, or at least make the trauma less impactful as the years go by?
There's certainly a lot of momentum that's, you know, building around addressing ACEs. And I think the first thing here is really raising awareness. You know, ACEs have been called the greatest unaddressed public health issue of our time. And surprisingly, there are still many pockets where there's a lack of awareness about ACEs and how pervasive its impact is. We're also learning more about how do we best prevent and intervene in these instances? One big one is really building supportive and nurturing relationships. Relationships heal. The other has to do with providing trauma-informed care in our schools, in our communities, in mental health services. Oftentimes, individuals who have suffered from ACEs will present with substance abuse, with acting out behavior, with behaviors that will put them in front of the juvenile justice system or the criminal justice system. And the approach here, really, when we talk about trauma-informed approaches, is how do we look beyond the behavior to think about what are the roots of the behavior and how does trauma play into it, and how do we reach out to these individuals in healing and not just punitive ways?
Are we generally becoming more enlightened at the need to identify things in children early and finding out that these formative years truly are formative years?
You know, our understanding of neurobiology is certainly causing us to look more towards prevention and how we sort of look towards infancy and early childhood as critical formative periods. You know, there was a time that we thought that brain development was just simple brain development. At some point, you were done. And now we recognize that brain development is really a process that begins from before birth and progresses all the way through adulthood. And we also recognize that your fight or flight response, if your stress responses are chronically activated, and ACEs do chronically activate your stress responses, it changes your neurobiology. It creates indelible imprints that will eventually show up as poorer physical health, as poorer emotional health, as poorer social health. And these are things that we didn't know then. So as our knowledge of neurobiology continues to expand, we learn more about how we really should be focusing on infancy and early childhood, and truly how determining they are of our life trajectories.
Dr. Vinny Chalani of Phoenix Children's Hospital. We've been talking about adverse childhood experiences.
The Mayo Clinic Medical School is opening a satellite campus here in the Valley. They're having their official ribbon-cutting ceremony this week and reviewing applications for their first class of students. Dr. Michelle Halyard is a radiation oncologist at Mayo and has become dean of its med school here. KJZZ's Naomi Gingold asked her about the new school and its progress.
We have renovated facilities on our Shea campus to house the medical students, and those are done and ready. We're in the process of interviewing students who have applied to Mayo Clinic School of Medicine Arizona campus. We intend to interview students all the way up until the early spring, and we'll start making offers for medical school admission after the first of the year.
You know, we have the University of Arizona Medical School here, different kinds of medical training facilities here. I'm wondering, why open a medical school here?
So I think the opening of the Arizona campus is part of our strategy to transform medical education. So it's more than just opening a campus of Mayo Clinic School of Medicine here in Arizona. So traditionally, medical students really focused a lot on learning how to take care of patients, and we certainly do that at Mayo. But increasingly, physicians of the future need to understand the healthcare delivery system in order to continuously improve it.
Some people might say, well, isn't the market already saturated?
For the size of the Phoenix metropolitan area, having just one medical school is really outside of the norm.
You've mentioned being a part of transforming medical education, and I want to know exactly what you mean by that.
So we focus on elements that are not traditionally taught in medical schools, such as systems engineering, bioinformatics, social and behavioral determinants of health, how to take care of healthy populations, how to promote health and wellness in populations, personalized health, so how to improve quality, safety in our healthcare system.
What does that mean, like, concretely? Like,
how to make sure that we can eliminate medical errors, for example, how to make sure that we're using evidence-based medicine as part of a standard way in which we deliver healthcare, how to make sure that we lower mortality rate in patients. The United States spends more money per capita on patient care than any other westernized country, but yet we know that some of our outcomes, such as leading health indicators, infant mortality, other things that are signs of health, really lag behind. So we need to educate our students, who are our future physicians, to improve the quality of care that we deliver to our patient population, including lowering cost.
But wouldn't a lot of med schools say, oh, we want to improve the quality of care of, like, general populations?
They do, but what we're doing with the science of healthcare delivery, it's part of a broader strategy. So in addition to high-value care, we're looking at population care management. We're looking at teaching our students leadership. We're looking at person-centered care. So how do you actually embark on shared decision-making with patients, for example? And we're also teaching principles of health economics, health policy, health law.
Dr. Halyard, you are currently a practicing radiation oncologist. When the school officially opens, are you going to kind of be moving full-time into the administration side and not be seeing patients anymore?
One of the unique things about Mayo Clinic is that virtually everyone in the organization that is a physician sees patients. And so I will be remaining as a practicing radiation oncologist, yet still doing my administrative duties. We are a physician-led organization, but we work in partnership with professional medical administrators.
Well, Dr. Halyard, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Michelle Halyard is dean of the new Mayo Medical School in Phoenix. She was speaking with the show's Naomi Gingold.
So, Mark, did you know it's Adoption Month?
I did not. Did you know it's Arizona Leafy Greens Month?
Thanks, Yuma.
And it's Careers in Construction Sciences Month.
That's oddly specific. So does that mean we can make November the show month?
Actually, there is a process of proclaiming special months, weeks, and days here in Arizona. There's an office over at the state capitol for that. The show's Annika Klein takes us on a field trip there.
The seal looks very official, I have to say.
People get really excited when they see a proclamation from the governor's office.
At first sight, it's just a piece of paper. a very fancy piece of paper labeling a certain day, week, or month. Laddie Shane is leafing through examples.
Let's see some that I have here that we've proved.
He's with the Governor's Office of Constituent Affairs.
Autism Awareness Month, Building Safety Month.
Some are more serious.
Bullying Prevention Month.
Some are fun.
Arizona Beer Week.
And some are very specific.
Diaper Need Awareness Week.
Shane is involved in approving all of them. Basically, in this office, every day is Proclamation Day. They turn out hundreds of these each year.
And we put together the report every week that the governor does see, and he can go through and edit and revise and do suggestions with the policy team.
Then it becomes official, stamped with that golden seal and signed by the governor, like a recent one that declared October Cybersecurity Awareness Month, a sign of the tech-heavy world we live in today. But proclamations go way back.
The process of proclaiming might be around since statehood.
I, John N. Goodwin, having been appointed by the President of the United States.
Melanie Sturgeon is the director of the State Archives. She's reading from the state's first proclamation, which dates back to 1863. It wasn't hard to find. It's hanging on the wall in the Archive and History Building.
I shall this day proceed to organize said government.
The first proclamation in Arizona was about the creation of Arizona as a territory.
What they would do is take that proclamation that they had all written their names on, and they would hand them out as they went through the state. If they came to a place where there were a group of people, they would get one so they would know.
It was basically a newsletter. In the early years of the state, proclamations had nothing to do with declaring a certain day or month as special. Instead, they were a way for the governor to outline what he wanted to focus on during that legislative session.
Here's another one from World War II. Firearms sales, soldiers coming back.
These early proclamations all originated in the governor's office. But it's a little different now.
People can go now to the governor and say, I would like a proclamation about this or that. And so there are a lot more of them than they used to have.
In fact, most proclamations now come from residents. They fill out a form online, and it goes to the Capitol for review. Barbie Engel has done this many times.
I think our first one that we requested was 2009.
Engel is president of the International Pain Foundation and an Arizona resident. She's behind Chronic Pain Awareness Month, Lupus Awareness Month, and a couple others. And she sees the proclamations process as sort of a side door to the legislature.
When the governor of the state signs off on it, it helps the other legislators see that this is an important issue.
And she says that thin piece of paper carries weight elsewhere, too.
There have been some patients that were unable to get treatment for their disease. And in their appeal to the insurance company, they included that the state governor had signed off on a proclamation.
She says in some cases, it made a difference. Her one critique of the process is this.
In the beginning, we didn't realize we had to apply every single year. We thought, oh my goodness, we got this proclamation. It's forever.
It's not. But it's worth it to Engel to send in applications every year, hoping they make it through Shane's office, onto the governor's desk, and back into her hands again. Stamped and ready to be presented to whoever doesn't know what month it is. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
So where is the real race for the White House? Well, it's here in the Valley, of course.
Yeah, not only are presidential candidates and their surrogates crisscrossing the state this week, there's also an actual race, though as KJZZ's Phil Latzman found out, it's not for votes, but for fun.
In this race, you can forget about the predictions and the pundits. And the only poll that matters is poll position. This weekend, one car will try to make Phoenix great again, while another will attempt to be faster together. It's all part of the festivities for this weekend's second annual Grand Prix of Scottsdale, where dozens of open-wheeled mini racers will vroom the streets of Old Town as it's transformed into a 1920s Great Gatsby-esque road course. One of the stylish go-karts will be Deborah Fiorentino. She's dressed up in a pantsuit representing the Hillary Clinton car.
I find myself in an early opportunity to beat Trump.
This race is very important to you, right?
It's extremely important. As we all know, Trump is going to spin out at the last round.
In blue suit with blonde wig is Andrew Brkanovich, who races as, yeah, you guessed it, Donald Trump. He says, not so fast.
Today, I'm going to beat Hillary. As a matter of fact, I'm going to build a wall, and she's going to run her car into the wall, big lead.
And if you lose, would it be rigged?
It will definitely be rigged. We will see at the time.
And with that, the two take off for a time trial through a downtown Phoenix alleyway.
Get set. Go!
And they're off. Trump and Clinton.
going at it in the alley here in Phoenix. And the winner is?
A tie.
A tie? Does it go to the Electoral College now, or what happens?
I think the Supreme Court decides.
And you can watch the Trump and Clinton cars compete for fun along with about 40 other mini races this Sunday at the Grand Prix of Scottsdale in Old Town. But there are lots of other activities associated around the event, and some of the proceeds go to a good cause. Jake Adams is with Southwest Human Development, a charity that specializes in assisting young families, serving over 130,000 people each year.
It's a whole weekend of parties, starting with the Gatsby Gala on Friday night. On Saturday, we have the Gatsby Lawn Party, which is a craft beverage and food tasting event along the waterfront in Scottsdale. And then Sunday is the actual race itself. All of the ticketed party events actually directly benefit our organization.
Calling this a race is a stretch. It's more like a tour. But in the final stretch of a presidential campaign, it's bipartisan fun in the streets of Scottsdale. And as F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote in The Great Gatsby, it takes two to make an accident. For the show, I'm Phil Latzman.
And you can see pictures of the Clinton and Trump cars and their competing doppelgangers at KJZZ.org. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.